Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's August 2020, and you're listening to episode 196, which is a discussion about Thomas Aquinas's Five Proofs for God. On this episode, I'm joined by Trent Horn, who is on staff with Catholic Answers and the author of five books, including Answering Atheism. Trent has written a feature article for the Christian Research Journal called Thomas Aquinas's Five Proofs for God Revisited, and you can read his article free online at our website, equip.org. Trent, it's good to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as I mentioned, Trent had written an article for us about Thomas Aquinas's Five Proofs for God that we use in apologetics, except for he lived in the 13th century. So a lot of Christians are not that familiar, as they should be, probably, with church history. So I just wanted to ask Trent to give us a little bit of a background for our listeners. Who is Thomas Aquinas, and why should Christians care who he was and study his work?
Sure. Well, Thomas was a philosopher and theologian who was born in 1225 and died in the year 1274. So he was a 13th century medieval scholar, and not just Catholics hold him in esteem, but even secular philosophers like Anthony Kenney, for example, has said he's one of the dozen greatest philosophers of all time. When you pick up anthologies on philosophy, even secular ones written by different philosophers that are used as textbooks in university courses, there will almost always be a chapter on Thomas Aquinas and on his writings, especially on his proofs for the existence of God. So what's interesting about Thomas, he was born in the Italian village of Aquino, hence that's why he's called Thomas Aquinas. And his family was very well off, and they wanted him to join a Benedictine monastery. But Thomas wanted to join a new religious order called the Dominicans, and his family wouldn't have any of it. So they actually kidnapped him, locked him in their family castle to dissuade him, and his brothers even hired a prostitute to lure him away from what he was doing. And instead, he grabbed a poker out of the fire. It was white hot, and he chased her out of the room. And then eventually they relented and let him go. And he went to study at the University of Paris. And he went on to write many seminal works and was important for the history of philosophy, but especially for Catholic theology and just really the defense of Christian theology in particular. For example, I recently had a debate with an atheist named Alex O'Connor, also known as the Cosmic Skeptic. And he has a very large YouTube following. So our debate has only been up since this recording only a few days, and over 50,000 people have viewed it. And in that debate, I used some of Thomas's arguments for the existence of God, and they're very robust, ones that you don't hear as much with popular theologians and philosophers today, but they actually did very well in the debate that I had with him. So he's highly esteemed, especially within the Catholic Church. Pope Leo XIII wrote an encyclical called Aeterni Patris in 1879. And in there, he spoke of Thomas Aquinas and said, "Among the scholastic doctors, the chief and master of all towers, Thomas Aquinas." So what made him especially important was that Thomas went back to older works, especially the Greek philosopher Aristotle, and took Aristotle's reasoning and logic and applied it to Christian theology to make it a really robust and formidable system of thought.
In fact, that story that you told about Thomas Aquinas and his family kidnapping him, I think I mentioned it on a podcast recently because we were talking about biblical sexuality. And I was just saying, you know, a lot of times we think of things today, like back, you know, Christians didn't struggle the way that we do with, you know, Christians who struggle with pornography or other things. But I said, you know, he had an actual nude prostitute in his room. So that seems like a big, you know, a big temptation that obviously he warded off with that hot poker and chased her off. But yes. I enjoy that story because that's something that I talk about, how some of these struggles that people have had have been there since the fall in Genesis. So you were talking about Thomas Aquinas as a Roman Catholic thinker, but is he simply a Roman Catholic thinker whose works wouldn't be of relevance to Protestants?
Oh, not at all. In fact, in the past several decades, we've seen quite the resurgence of interest in Thomas Aquinas from Protestant authors, several of whom call themselves evangelical Thomists. So while they don't accept the Catholicism that Thomas himself believed in, they appreciate his philosophical insights and his methods of approaching different issues. Probably one of the most famous evangelical Thomists is the late Norm Geisler. So he's written on that subject. You also see, actually, in the Reformed tradition of Protestant Christianity, many Reformed thinkers really appreciate Thomas's writings and use his arguments to defend more classical attributes of God that are sometimes lost in modern discourse about God. So many of them owe a debt to Thomas when it comes to defending doctrines or attributes of God, like divine simplicity, that God is not composed of parts. He is absolute being itself. God is immutable. Nothing changes God. We don't make God have emotions, for example. He's immutable, impassible, that he's timeless, as also how to answer questions related to how a timeless God can become incarnate, or how a simple God can be triune. And so you have thinkers like Paul Helm, James Dolezal approaching this. Also, when it comes to defending the doctrine of predestination, you find Thomas's articulation of predestination is very similar to the Reformed or Calvinist view of predestination, though with certain important qualifications. So I think many Protestant thinkers would find a lot in Thomas's writings that they actually agree with and can benefit from.
So you go over different things in this article because you specifically are talking about his five proofs for God. Yes. And one thing that you mention is the term summa theologia. And so can you tell us a little bit about what is that?
Sure. So the Summa Theologia, also called the Summa, is probably Thomas's most famous work. Essentially, it's a compendium or a collection of the theological teachings of the Catholic Church at that time when Thomas wrote it. So he composed it over many years, between 1265 up till about the end of his life in 1274. And from that, he compiled major teachings of the Catholic Church, really of Christian theology, on God, creation, the nature of man, the nature of Christ, the sacraments, virtue, morality, and compiled this together. And his goal was to create something that would essentially be almost like a textbook to help beginners to understand theology. And when he wrote this at the beginning of the preface of the Summa, and there's other Summas he wrote, he also wrote Summa Contra Gentiles, which was a collection of writings against those who were critics of the Catholic faith. His voluminous writings, millions and millions of words that the man had written. But I love what he says in the preface of the Summa. He says, "We have considered that students in this doctrine have not seldom been hampered by what they have found written by other authors." So his goal was to improve other religious authors of his time who he thought were just terrible writers. He said, "Partly on account of the multiplication of useless questions, articles, and arguments, and partly also because those things that are needful for them to know are not taught according to the subject matter." So he begins and says, you know, we want this to be an instruction for beginners and to improve on all the failed theology manuals of the past. Though when you start to read it, you sort of feel that you have a lack of intelligence, that if this prose is for beginners, I can't imagine the writing for the advanced students, because there's so many theological insights. It's rich and intricate. And the way Thomas approaches questions is wonderful. What he does is he'll have a question, and he will put forward objections to the Christian position. And then he will put forward his answer, and then he will proceed to answer those objections he previously raised. So he believes in really approaching the strongest counterarguments to one's position. And so he starts the Summa with the most basic thing you can think of, which would be the existence of God.
So your article, as I mentioned, is specifically called Thomas Aquinas's Five Proofs for God, and then you say revisited. But probably most people are not familiar with what those five proofs are. So what are the five ways of proving God exists?
Sure. So when Thomas opens up the Summa, he begins with the question, can we know that God exists? And actually, before the five ways, he asks the question, well, is the knowledge of God self-evident? Is it just obvious that God exists? Or we can know just by using reason and thinking about God, we can know that it is true that God exists in the same way that if we use reason and we think about like the laws of logic, for example, we can know that A cannot be A and not A at the same time, that it's just self-evidently true, or that we, you and I can know that, while of course Thomas didn't articulate this, it wouldn't be fully articulated until René Descartes centuries later, but I'm sure Thomas would agree that it's self-evidently true that you and I exist, or at least you and I are having thoughts. We may wonder how it is we're having thoughts, but we are. It's self-evidently true we're having thoughts about different things. So Thomas begins, he says, well, is it self-evidently true? And he says, no, it's not. And that was controversial because a century earlier, Saint Anselm of Canterbury, who was the bishop in what is now England, proposed an argument for God, saying that God is self-evident, that God, by definition, must exist because he's no greater can be conceived than God, right? If I can think of something bigger than God, then that's God. So the biggest thing I can think of is a God who really exists. That would be the ontological argument. Now, Thomas rejected the ontological argument. He said, well, the ontological argument, for Thomas's perspective, hinges on having direct knowledge of God's essence or what God is. But we don't have direct knowledge of that. We can't know what God is directly because God is infinite. He's so far beyond us. Instead, Thomas said, well, we can only know God's essence by reasoning from effects here in the world, by looking around at us and seeing the world around us, and then reasoning backward from the effects to an ultimate cause of the universe itself. And so from here, he puts forward in the beginning five ways to do that. Now, it's really important to remember that this is a summary for beginners. So this is Thomas putting forward just kind of five refresher arguments, if you will, for the beginners reading his theology manual. He never intended that these five arguments by themselves constituted the entire case for the existence of God. In fact, he writes in other places, like in his work on being and essence, he has a more developed argument for the existence of God. He also has more developed arguments in the Summa Contra Gentiles. So Ed Fazer, who is a philosopher who has written a wonderful book on Thomas called Aquinas, A Beginner's Guide, he says, Aquinas never intended for the five ways to stand alone and would probably have reacted with horror if told that future generations of students would be studying them in isolation, removed from their original immediate context in the Summa Theologia and the larger context of his work as a whole. So while Thomas is brilliant, what happens is a lot of times that those people only see just the five ways and they don't get a full understanding of it because they don't get Thomas's work as a whole to put it into context.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Trent Horn. He has written a feature article for the Christian Research Journal. It's called Thomas Aquinas's Five Proofs for God Revisited. You can read it for free online at our website, equip.org. Now, I cannot believe it, but it's been 4 years since we started this podcast, and we are almost up to episode 200, which will be a big milestone for us. And one way that you can help us keep this podcast going, because it's completely free to you, is to help other people find it. And the best way you do that, and it's no monetary cost at all, is just give us a review. It's easy to just give a starred review. It just takes seconds, really. Or if you can think about it for a moment and just write a short one or two sentence review that helps describe the podcast and why you enjoy it for others to discover it and also to subscribe, that would be great. So just go to Apple Podcasts and look at Postmodern Realities and give us your review, or give us a review wherever you get your podcasts. We would really appreciate it. The other way you can continue to help us and partner with us with our content is to subscribe to the Christian Research Journal. It's $33.50, and you can do that at our website, equip.org. Or if that is too much for your budget this month, a tip would be greatly appreciated. Something like $3 or $5 $10, whatever you have in your budget would be great. It's easy to give a tip. All you do is go to the website, equip.org, find magazine, go to the drop-down menu. The second choice is Postmodern Realities. Hit that. And really, at any landing page, you can find the link to give us a tip. So we thank you for all the ways that you're partnering with us and help us go continue this podcast beyond 200 episodes. So we appreciate your partnership. Well, you're just talking about the five ways of proving God exists that Thomas wrote about. And you were just earlier talking about how you have recently debated an atheist. So how have atheists misunderstood the five ways? And why do you think so many people, atheists like Richard Dawkins in his book, The God Delusion, chose to focus on them in particular?
Well, I think the reason that they focus on the arguments is because they're so famous. And one reason that they're famous is that future philosophers, ever since Thomas's time, have used them as a foil to argue against natural theology. So natural theology is the subset of theology that uses reason and natural philosophy to argue for the existence of God. So theology, of course, deals with divine revelation, what God may have revealed to us in his word, for example. But also there's natural theology that we can look around. Romans 1:20, St. Paul says that the evidence of his divine attributes are clearly perceived in what he has made. So we can, in Psalm 19:1, the sky proclaims its builder's craft, the heavens are the handiwork of God. So we can follow these clues back to God, and future philosophers have looked back on the five ways and kind of used them, I think, as a foil to try to refute them. But once again, it's easy. They're very short. They're just a few hundred words, maybe 1,000 or 2,000 words. They're not very long for these five ways. And so what ended up happening, I think, often is that in the 19th, especially in the 20th and 21st centuries, this happened to me. I went to an undergrad philosophy course. My first course is an undergrad philosophy 101, and you get your anthology of philosophers. And in the middle, you get to Thomas Aquinas. And what do you have? An excerpt of the five ways. And you read them, and then your professor tells you what's wrong with them, which isn't fair because Thomas goes on to expound on them even more and to answer what are other objections that people might make against them. So Dawkins recognizes this in The God Delusion. It's so funny. He says that he's hesitant to do so, but he says the five ways are intellectually vacuous. Of course, what's really vacuous is Dawkins' approach to them and many other atheists, because they simply don't understand Thomas's arguments. They don't appreciate the metaphysical framework that he uses when he makes these arguments, because what Thomas is doing is he's taking the metaphysics of Aristotle, you know, writing over 1,000 years earlier, and applies it to Christian theology and to the Christian faith. And so he takes a lot of those principles into these arguments that really what Thomas is doing is he's taking arguments that were made by Aristotle a long time earlier to argue for a prime mover or an ultimate cause. And Dawkins and other modern atheists, I think, sometimes take modern arguments for the existence of God and read them into Aquinas when that's not actually the point Aquinas is making. So I'd like you to describe or tell us about each of the five ways. So what is the first way? Sure. And this is the way that Thomas says is the most evident and manifest way to prove the existence of God. So Thomas offers five different arguments for the existence of God, but even he admits that they're not all of equal strength. And I would agree with him. I would say, actually, as you go through the arguments, they actually tend to get weaker. Or at the very least, the first way that Thomas argues for is probably the strongest way. And this would be called the argument from motion. And so it basically goes something like this. Now, it can be misleading when you think of motion. You just think of local motion, objects moving in their spatial location. But this is, once again, where critics like Dawkins end up misunderstanding Aquinas, is that Aquinas is not just talking about motion like local motion. The word motion for Aquinas, drawing from Aristotle, is really a word that means change. And so what Aquinas is getting at here is the riddle of change. How can there be change? This goes all the way back to the pre-Socratic philosophers like Parmenides, who said, well, look, how do things change? Now, you and I might think, well, what's the big riddle? So what they would say is, look, something is either existent or non-existent. It's actual or it doesn't exist. So let's take water. It actually exists. But how does water become ice? There's no ice that's present. The ice doesn't exist. For the water to become ice, you have to take something that doesn't exist, and it comes into existence. It seems to come into existence from nothing. So that led early pre-Socratic philosophers, those the Greek philosophers before Socrates, like Parmenides, arguing that change was an illusion. The same thing happens with Zeno, who says like the arrow moving through the sky. He had these paradoxes that tried to show that motion we perceive or change, that they're illusory, because change can't happen. Things are either actual or they're non-existent. So if it's not here, it can't just pop into existence from nothing. So Aristotle thread the needle and said, no, wait, it's not that there's actual and non-existent. There's a middle ground, potential. There are things that exist in an actual way, and they exist as a potential or a potency, and that all substances are a composite of act and potency, actual and potential. So whenever change happens, what Thomas says is change or motion, whenever it happens, that happens only when a potential is reduced to an actual. So you can take, for example, the classic example would be someone moving a stone with a stick. The stone's potential to move is actualized by the stick. The stick's potential to move is actualized by the hand. The hand is actualized by something else. To use a more modern example, we could look at train cars, like boxcars on a train track. A boxcar cannot move itself. You have a boxcar on a train track, it cannot move. It has a potential to move, but actually, it just sits still. That potential to move can only be actualized by something else. It cannot be actualized by the boxcar itself, because then you would have something actualizing its own potential, and it would be actual and potential at the same time, which would be a contradiction. That's why water doesn't freeze itself. Another force actualizes that. The boxcar doesn't move itself. Another boxcar pulls it. So Thomas, in his argument from motion the first way, he says, well, could there be an infinite number of movers? He says, no, because that wouldn't explain why there's any motion at all. Like, return to the boxcars. If a boxcar on a train track is moving, you might say, well, it's pulled by another boxcar, or it's pulled by another boxcar. Well, maybe there's an infinite number of boxcars, each pulling one before it. Well, that doesn't answer the question. Even if you had an infinite number of them, they would sit still. Instead, there has to be a car that is different in kind, a car that gives motion without receiving it, an unpulled puller, if you will. That's the locomotive. And the same thing Thomas says when it comes to the series of changes in motion in our universe, there must be something, an ultimate cause, that is just pure actuality. It has no potency whatsoever. If it's purely actual, it explains all of the change in motion that we see, but it doesn't receive any change or motion from anything else. And then what Thomas does is he goes on with the argument, if it's pure actuality, he's able to easily logically derive God's key divine attributes. So, for example, if God is purely actual, then he must be infinite. If he were finite, he would have a potential. He would have a potential at his finite boundary. Also, God is simple. If he's purely actual, he can't have any division within him. So he must be simple. He can't change. If God could change, he would have a potency to actualize. So he's immutable. God also has to be timeless. He has to be timeless because time is a measure of change, and God has no potency to actualize in change. So what's great about the argument from motion is that you get to this pure actual cause, and then it's pretty easy to derive the divine attributes from it, as opposed to other arguments for the existence of God that just get you to a cause of the universe, but it's harder to infer what the precise attributes are of this cause to understand that it's God. And so I think it's a very helpful argument. A full expanded treatment of the argument can be found in Ed Fazer's book, Five Proofs for the Existence of God. He calls it the Aristotelian proof, and he synthesizes Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas's view on the matter.
So why don't you go over for us the second and third ways? Although when I'm asking about these ways, I feel like I'm asking you about The Mandalorian on Disney, if everyone's seen that one. They talk about the way, but this is a better way. This is about God. So why don't you tell us a little bit about those two ways?
Sure. So the second and third ways round out the first three ways, which would be cosmological arguments. They use modern lingo. So a cosmological argument for God says we look at the universe as a whole. It points back to an ultimate cause of the universe, which would be God. And the second way is similar to the argument for motion, but it talks about causation itself. What Aquinas says is nothing is caused by itself. Every effect has a prior cause. And again, we are pushed back into regress. This has to be terminated by a first cause, which we call God. Now, Dawkins totally misunderstands the argument. Dawkins says, well, maybe just the Big Bang is the cause of everything. It's a classic misunderstanding of Aquinas' second way. Aquinas is not saying you go back in all the causes and you get a first cause in time, and then you get a universe from nothing. In fact, Thomas Aquinas was skeptical. He didn't think you could prove the universe began to exist from nothing by reason. He accepted it on faith because that's what God had revealed in Genesis and what the church taught. But he didn't think you could prove it by reason alone. But he said what you could prove was that even if these causes per impossible, like when he's dealing with his Greek critics who accepted Aristotle's view the universe is eternal, Aquinas would tell them, look, even if you guys are right that the universe, there's infinite causes going back, there isn't a first temporal cause for you guys, but there has to be a first hierarchical cause. So instead of there being like an infinite series of dominoes, for Thomas, he'd say causation is more like a series of gears. So imagine a series of gears interlocking teeth with each other. If one gear leaves the series, none of the other gears spin. There has to be instead a central gear that is spinning and making all the other ones spin as a result. Or another image you could use, imagine mirrors. You arrange mirrors so they form an infinite series of mirrors, right? If you put mirrors next to each other, they form infinite reflections. Even if you have infinite reflections, you won't have a face in the infinite reflections unless you peer into the first mirrors. The mirrors themselves can't generate the face. The face sets out that primary cause hierarchically, and then it goes throughout the infinite mirrors. Thomas would say the same thing for God, that he's that hierarchical cause for this causal series, even if it were infinite in nature. And then the third way is contingency. So Thomas says that there must have been a time, he says that things that exist, they don't have to exist. They can go out of existence. And he says, if that's the case and the universe has been around forever, well, that would mean that eventually everything would have gone out of existence at one point. But if everything went out of existence, there'd be nothing now. And so what follows from that is that there has to be a necessary cause that sustains these contingent things that can fail to exist. Now, what I will say, though, is that that's a brief overview of contingency, because when Dawkins and others criticize this, Aquinas uses contingency in a way that's different and as a term from modern philosophers. But there are still a lot of similarities with the argument that Aquinas says the nature of matter, because it's a composite, all matter is a composite of, you know, matter and form, potency and actuality. And because of this, it cannot endure forever over time. And so Thomas would say, look, if it can't endure forever over time, there would be nothing. But if there was nothing at some point in the past, there'd be nothing now. There is something now. So there must be something that is necessary that keeps everything in existence. And he says that would be God.
So the fourth argument is the one from perfection. So why don't you describe to our listeners what that is? What did Aquinas mean by the argument from perfection?
Yes. So the fourth way of Aquinas's five ways is the one that puzzles even Thomistic scholars to this day to try to wrap their heads around. I myself would say that it's the weakest of the five because of what we're trying to understand Thomas is getting at. It's almost a kind of Platonic argument that argues from existing things in this world being imperfect that naturally lead to the existence of a perfection of those things. Now, of course, Thomas did not believe in the Platonic theory of the forms, which is the idea that everything we see is just a shadow of that perfect thing in this Platonic heaven. So all chairs are just shadows of the form of the chair. All dogs are reflections of the form of the dog. Thomas rejected that because God is the absolute foundation of all things. He doesn't exist alongside these kind of Platonic forms. If these universal ideas exist anywhere as ideas, they're going to exist in the divine mind. So you might call this, the first three are cosmological arguments. You could call this an axiological argument. Axiological being a Greek word that refers to values. And so Thomas is making here an argument based on values and goodness and the gradation we see, that if we see things reflecting gradients in goodness, that it naturally follows from this gradient that there is a maximum. Now, Aquinas says in particular that for any genus, there is a maximum that provides being to the other things within that genus or type of being to explain its existence. So when it comes to just being itself or existence itself, there has to be something that has maximal amount of being. And so that maximal amount of being would be another reference to God. And of course, this argument is hopelessly misunderstood by atheists who don't try to read it charitably. They only seek to refute it. And even if many philosophers today who are Catholic would say, well, I wouldn't say the fourth way is a great argument for God, but they try to understand it as much as they can and see what Aquinas is getting at here. And so when we do this, you have people like Dawkins who say, this is Dawkins' rebuttal to the argument. He says, you might as well say people vary in smelliness, but we can make the comparison only by reference to a perfect maximum of conceivable smelliness. Therefore, there must exist a preeminently peerless stinker, and we call him God. So Dawkins would say, well, if this argument proves God, if things we see here imply a maximum, therefore, if there's a smelly thing, there's a maximum smelly thing. If there's a scary thing, there's a maximum scary thing. If there's a stupid thing, there's a maximum stupid thing. So this argument, by reductio ad absurdum, shows maximum silly entities exist, and it can't be used to show God exists. But that's not the right way to go about the argument, because from Aquinas's perspective, deficiencies we see like smelliness or stupidity, those are not beings in themselves. They're an absence of being. For Thomas's perspective, evil is not a thing that God made or deficiencies. It's an absence of being. It's a privation of being or goodness. And so when we see things that have malodorous smells or are broken or not intelligent, we rightly say that there's a deficiency in that thing. It's lacking what it ought to have in order to function in accordance with its being. And so then when we look at God, we see that God is the maximum. Now, of course, God, when it comes to a genus, must be very clear here. God is not a kind of being that exists in a type and gives existence to that type. God is not a being. God is being. He's not a being. God just is infinite being itself. And so he gives being and existence to all creatures. So Peter Kraft and Ronald Tocelli, in their Handbook of Christian Apologetics, here's how they summarize Thomas's fourth way. If these degrees of perfection pertain to being, and being is caused in finite creatures, then there must exist a best, a source and real standard of all perfections that we belong to as beings. This absolutely perfect being, the being of all beings, the perfection of all perfections, is God. And what I love about Kraft and Tocelli, they answer some objections to this argument. And one of the objections is, well, how do we know that better isn't a subjective term? You know, how do we know there's really an objective better? And their reply is great. They say, well, there is an objective better. For example, you wouldn't have asked this question unless you thought it was better to do so than not. So I love how they cover it. And Kraft and Tocelli's Handbook of Christian Apologetics is still a classic. It covers the five ways and then 15 other arguments for the existence of God.
So the fifth way of Aquinas is the argument from design. So can you describe to us what that argument is about and why you think that some atheists misunderstand it?
Yes. So when atheists misunderstand this argument, so think of this. The first three are cosmological arguments. The existence of the universe leads to God. The fourth way we could call an axiological argument, that values and goodness, things that we value or have value in virtue of their being lead to God. The fifth way would be a teleological argument, or the argument from design. Now, many atheists today misunderstand that because their familiarity with teleological arguments tend to focus on complexity and saying that complexity cannot arise naturally. So their teleological arguments they're familiar with rebutting might be the fine-tuning argument, or in particular, arguments that say biological evolution is insufficient to account for the complexity of organic life, things like intelligent design, for example. And so Dawkins and others will just lump Aquinas's fifth way into that, and they'll say that it's just the same thing as William Paley's watchmaker argument. You find a watch in the same sand. It's complex. It has ordered parts. It must be designed by someone. And the natural world is more complex than a watch. Therefore, we have stronger warrant to believe in a designer. Aquinas's argument is more about the fact that he focuses on order and regularity in natural bodies that act towards particular ends. So for Aquinas, he believes in causation, that there are four causes. There are the material causes, the materials that give rise to things, their form, how the materials are arranged together, the efficient cause, so that the reason that brings the thing into existence, and the final cause, or its ultimate end. And so Aquinas says you can even see in nature final causes of these things that create their order and regularity that can't exist without an intelligible guider. So what he says is things which lack intelligence, such as natural bodies, act for an end. And this is evident from their acting always or nearly always in the same way so as to obtain the best result. Aquinas then says that just as an arrow cannot hit a target without an archer, unintelligent forces cannot achieve their regular ends without an intelligent cause, which is God. So for Aquinas, even if the universe were just an electron orbiting a nucleus, he would say that's enough to prove that God exists because the electron does not have within itself the intelligence to have that ordered regularity. Now, what some people fire back is like Bertrand Russell will say, well, that's just laws of nature. And it's funny, when atheists appeal to laws of nature, well, the laws of nature explain that. The laws of nature are descriptive laws. Like when you fall down, there's no law of gravity making you do something to obey it. The laws of nature are shorthand terms to describe the inherent tendencies of objects. So if you think about it, when we look at the law of gravity, it describes the inherent tendency of objects in space-time to act in particular ways. So to say laws of nature explain this regularity pushes the question back, because the laws only say, well, objects that we observe have natural tendencies to act in particular regular ways. Well, why do they have that? And that would naturally lead to an argument of the kind like St. Thomas Aquinas in his fifth way.
In your article, you write at the end of it, quote, "We should remember that not all of these arguments will be persuasive equally to people," end quote. And so how can the Christian apologists most effectively use these five arguments?
Well, I think what he should do is look over the five arguments, but then also study in depth Aquinas's works, as well as the works of other scholastic theologians, philosophers, and modern philosophers who have commented on Aquinas's works and sharpened the arguments against modern criticisms of them, both against the arguments and from Aquinas's conclusions on things like the attributes of God. So modern Thomistic scholars one can look at would be people like Eleanor Stump, Brian Davies, Brian Leftow, Ed Fazer, as I mentioned earlier, has some good resources on this. So when we look at this, you can then see the five ways. And what I find helpful, like in my debate with Alex O'Connor, I just focused on the argument from motion because I thought that that argument itself, I can actually derive the divine attributes of God from it. And I agree with Thomas that it's the first and most evident and manifest way to prove God exists. So if you can center on just a few key strong arguments, you might as well do that. And then I would just recommend understanding Thomas as a whole so you understand his metaphysics, what he means by these terms, so you can understand that, because the most serious objections to Aquinas' arguments for the existence of God go against the foundation of his scholastic Aristotelian metaphysical worldview. So his synthesis of Aristotle's philosophy with Christian theology, the most potent criticisms go against that basic metaphysic. And so I would recommend just pursuing other modern resources that comment on that, explain it, and then defend it against modern objections. If your listeners want to go more in depth on this subject, the three resources I would give would be Aquinas, A Beginner's Guide by Ed Fazer, A Shorter Summa by Peter Kraft, which is Aquinas' Summa, but condensed down in more bite-sized format, and a wonderful podcast called Pints with Aquinas by my friend Matt Frad.
Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid-fire questions for Trent. So, Trent, you live in Southern California. Tacos or In-N-Out Burger?
Depends on my mood for the day, but you can never go wrong with a double-double.
Introvert or extrovert?
introvert, very introverted.
Early bird or night owl?
Night owl. I can't get up early, and I have kids, and I still try.
Highly organized, or are you more go with the flow?
Highly organized, but in a very idiosyncratic way.
And what's something on your bucket list?
On my bucket list would be I've been to Israel twice, and I'd love to go back, and I'd love to take my children with me. It's my favorite place to visit in the world. So that would be the end of my bucket list.
Well, thank you, Trent, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. Would love to come back anytime.
You've been listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest has been Trent Horn, who has written a feature article for the Christian Research Journal. It's called Thomas Aquinas's 5 Proofs for God Revisited. You can read his article completely free online at our website, equip.org. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. And please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and please rate and review our podcast. When you rate and review our podcast, it helps others see our content. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast, hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK, Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.